Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us here this morning. So I'm pleased to be here to be able to talk about the work that I did in Sierra Leone. So as she said, I work with the CDC, and I deployed to Sierra Leone last March, and I was there for a month with the health promotion team. So what's important to remember is the work that was being conducted in West Africa for the Ebola outbreak had a very specific purpose, and the purpose was to get to zero, to have zero cases in each country. So all the work that we did was going towards that mission. So although I'll be talking about data that was collected for focus groups that we did with traditional healers, the purpose wasn't because we're interested specifically for a research purpose. It was very mission specific about how to talk to the community and get the information that we needed in order to incorporate into the response to reduce the number of cases. And also, as you may know now, Sierra Leone has zero cases as of August. So we were very pleased to hear that news, everybody who was involved in the fight against Ebola. So quick background, so I'm just going to probably just breeze through the background on Ebola and the 2014 outbreak. Talk a little bit about Sierra Leone, the Port Local District, the work that the health promotion team was conducted, and then really focus on the focus groups that were conducted with traditional healers, the methods, results, and the conclusion. So this was the largest Ebola outbreak epidemic in history, and also the largest outbreak response in CDC's history. And I was actually, I've only been with the CDC for about a year and a half. So about 6 months in, I deployed. So it was an interesting experience for me, as for somebody who hasn't been with the CDC that long, but had that amazing opportunity to go to West Africa and help in this response. So Ebola was first discovered in 1976 near the Ebola River in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so as the previous presenter talked about, this is a re-emerging disease. So outbreaks occur sporadically in Africa. So what's really important to remember with regard to this presentation and just in general, transmission of the Ebola virus spreads through direct contact with somebody who's sick, but also somebody who's showing symptoms. And that's contact through broken skin or unprotected membranes. So signs and symptoms, and I'm going to talk about this a lot because that's something that's important to recognize while we were doing this work. Fever, headache, fatigue, muscle pain, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, and unexplained hemorrhage. And the incubation period for Ebola is about 2 to 21 days. So we're going to talk about 21 days a lot specifically. If any family member or patient had Ebola or contact with an Ebola patient, the quarantine period was always 21 days. But the average incubation period was about 8 to 10 days. So Sierra Leone has a population of a little over 5 million as of July 2015. And what's important is that Sierra Leone is still recovering from the civil war, which ended in 2002. And you can see that it's bordered by Guinea and Liberia, which are the other two countries severely affected by Ebola. It's a pretty young population. About 40% is under 14 years of age. The religion includes a mix of Muslim, Christian, and indigenous beliefs. And the languages were English, Creole, Mende, Timni, and Fula. So this is just a map of the districts of Sierra Leone. So in Sierra Leone, you have the country as a whole, and then within the country, you have the districts. And within each district, you have chiefdoms, and within the chiefdoms, you have villages. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So the capital of Sierra Leone is Freetown, which is over here in the Western District. And I work primarily in Port Local District, which is about 3 hours away from the capital. So from May 2014 to the present, there are a little over 8,000 laboratory-confirmed Ebola cases in Sierra Leone and about 4,000 deaths. And as I said, as of August, we had zero cases. So I work primarily in the Port Local District, which is a pretty rural district, almost 500,000 population. Creole and Timni were the main languages, and it was also predominantly Muslim. So I was in Sierra Leone in March 2015, and as of March, there are about 1,400 confirmed cases in the Port Loko district. So although there were a lot of districts in Sierra Leone, there were a few that were the high priority districts, and that's where most of the responders would go to do this kind of work, and Port Loko was one of those districts. So I worked with the health promotion team, and we had a behavioral assessment strategy. So at the beginning of the response, the main objective, well not objective, but a lot of the work was really put into communication and campaigns and getting the people to understand what Ebola is, that it's real, signs and symptoms, and how to prevent transmission. But by January, there was a lot of data that came out that showed that the public understood signs and symptoms of Ebola, how it was transmitted and how to prevent it. There were chlorine washing stations everywhere. People understood that they had to wash their hands. There was a social distancing rule where they shouldn't be too close to people or touch people. And if anybody seemed like they had any symptoms of Ebola, they were supposed to call the Ebola response line, which was 117. So at this point in the response, the health promotion team started to work on more of a behavioral assessment strategy. So what we noticed was that although people knew what was going on and understood the signs and symptoms and how to prevent Ebola, that behaviors were still leading to transmission. So our point was to identify, understand, and address the behavioral issues associated with the Ebola transmission. And so we did this mostly using qualitative research. So we did interviews and focus groups with community members. So if there were cases that came out, we would go to out in the field and go to the homes of the family members. We would talk to family members, friends, anybody in the community to find out what was going on before that person started to get sick. Where did they go? Who did they talk to? And what kind of behaviors kind of led up to them getting sick? Again, to understand what is going on, why, and how to change these behaviors. So this was our targeted behavioral response process. So first, the health promotion team, and we had maybe one or two health promotion team members in each district. In Port Loko, I was the only one there, so it was pretty much just me. But there were a lot of other CDC responders there, as well as WHO, UNICEF, and a lot of NGOs. So we really had to work together in the response. So I worked at first with the district level EPIs. So everyone in the EPIs would get a list of new cases or contacts that they would track. So they would make line lists, and they would go out to the homes to track the contacts and make sure that people were either staying in their quarantine homes, making sure that nobody was having signs and symptoms of Ebola. So what we would do is we would work with the EPIs to get the new cases and then identify and prioritize cases or situations that might benefit from a behavioral assessment. After we did that we would generate the behavioral data through field investigation. Again, so we'd go in the field and conduct interviews, focus groups, and just talk to people to figure out what was going on and kind of what led up to transmission. From there, we would provide evidence-based recommendations to the partners. And again, this had to be a really quick turnaround to provide recommendations that could immediately be implemented into the response. So then we had a list of priority cases. So like I said, the EPIs would get the list of the new cases and the contacts every morning, and then the health promotion team would focus on specific cases that warranted a behavioral response. So the first two were probably the most, I wouldn't say the most important, but the biggest response that we got with regard to importance of our work, traditional burials. A traditional burial in Sierra Leone, and this varies from different districts, countries in West Africa. So traditional burials typically included a lot of hands-on with the dead body. So washing the dead body, cleaning it, clothing it, also a lot of singing and praying. So it was a big ceremony. And this is something that was ingrained in their culture and the tradition for centuries. Unfortunately, because of this practice, they saw an emergence of Ebola cases that came out after traditional burials, just because there was so much hands-on during the ceremony, so they noticed cases that were linked to traditional burials. So what they did was they pretty much outlawed traditional burials. So, which, if you think about it, is really hard to do. So, you know, if you're telling people that they can't practice something that that's ingrained in their culture, and you tell them they can't do it anymore, people are just going to do it in secret, which is what happened. So, when we would hear about traditional burials, that would be something that we would have to kind of talk to family members to find out what was going on, and then the EPIs would track those cases. So similarly, traditional healer practice, again, this is something that is ingrained in their culture and traditions, where these traditional healers were really vital in the care of the community. Again, traditional healer practice also included a lot of hands-on practice, touching and rubbing and for healing purposes. So once again, they saw emergence of cases with traditional healers kind of in the center of these like transmission chains. So they outlawed traditional healer practice again. So again, you see that there's something that's ingrained in the culture and the tradition of these people, and they're saying that they can't do it. So again, people were just doing it in secret, and then we would find an emergence of cases with traditional healers and their patients. Recurrent infections in a quarantine home was also a priority situation. So when a home is quarantined, they get visited every day by contact tracers. So they also get visited by people who educate them on social distancing and washing their hands and how to prevent transmission. So ideally, there shouldn't be recurrent infections in a quarantine home, because those are the ones who got the most attention, because people were there every day, and they also told them, you know, about the signs and symptoms, and if anybody gets sick, make sure to call 117. Health worker infections obviously was very important. New cases that were not from a line list was important, because we didn't know the source case, so that was also a priority situation for us, and also a positive swab in the home. So any death in Sierra Leone was swabbed to test for Ebola. It doesn't matter what you died from. They swabbed everybody who passed. So a positive swab in a home, technically, in their mind, shouldn't happen, because if anybody is sick or shows any signs or symptoms of Ebola, you're supposed to call the Ebola response line, 117, so that they can be taken to an Ebola treatment unit. So obviously that wasn't happening, and people were still dying in their homes from Ebola. So as I mentioned, the traditional healers are a vital part of the care system. Typically, they take the place of Western care, especially in these more remote and rural villages and districts, like the one that I was in Port Loko. And as I mentioned, the practice was officially banned during the outbreak. And again, these traditional healers, they're a vital part of the community, and the community really trusts them. So anytime anything, they were sick, or it didn't even have to do with health, but they were the leaders and the healers in the community. So people went to them for questions, for help, really for anything. And again, their practice was banned during the outbreak, so people were, some were healing in secret. So as I said, we started to notice Ebola cases with traditional healers within the transmission chain, as well as involvement in unsafe burials. So this is a really simple, or even bad, example of a transmission chain. I wasn't able to show the real ones because it has obviously identifiable information, but this gives you a good idea of what they would look like. So you would have a patient, and the transmissions chain would pretty much just show the different contacts that this person has, and if that person was, you know, just had contact with them but didn't get Ebola, and then also show patients who actually got Ebola. So there was quite a few transmission chains in Port Loko with traditional healers within the center or within somewhere in the transmission chain, and their family members and other patients who were also contacts, and some eventually patients. So going back to the behavioral assessment strategy, so we identified a priority, which was transmission with traditional healers and their patients. So the method was to kind of talk to traditional healers to kind of find out what's going on in this community. So the purpose was to assess the knowledge of Ebola, identify perception of the Ebola response, and explore willingness to engage in Ebola prevention activities. So this was a collaboration between the CDC and Focus 1000, and Focus 1000 is a local NGO in Sierra Leone. So in Port Loco, there are 11 chiefdoms, and so we did 7 focus groups in 7 of the 11 chiefdoms with a total of 63 participants. So with regard to recruitment, so the methods are obviously will be a little different than focus group or qualitative methods that we do here. So typically the Focus 1000 representative, which was a local, would go out to the chief about a week before to ask for permission to conduct groups. And so anything that was done in any of the chiefdoms, you had to get the chief's permission before you do anything. Unfortunately, there were people who didn't know that, and they would go into the chiefdoms and try to conduct work, and then they would get kicked out and never invited back, and that really brought negative ideas about the response and the Westerners that were there trying to work. So that was something that was really critical, to make sure that somebody spoke to the chief to make sure we had his permission to do this work. So typically the chief would contact either the head of the Healers Council or somebody to kind of facilitate the recruitment and the location and time to get the healers there for the focus group. And again, also, just to pay our respect, we would visit the chief before and after the group to thank him for allowing us to come into his chiefdom and talk to the healers. So the groups were typically in an empty schoolhouse. So at this time, school was still not in session because of the outbreak. So it was in a schoolhouse or community meeting space. So in Port Loco, like I said, Timni was the local language, but most people also spoke Creole. And the focus group team included myself and another CDC person who was there for some of the time, the Focus 1000 participants, and we had a facilitator, a translator as well as a note taker. So it was really interesting dynamic, especially for me because I don't speak the language. So we had the trained facilitator who spoke Creole. The translator asked questions in Timni, and then he would also translate back to me in English so that I could ask follow-up questions. So it was a really kind of interesting dynamic. So I'm asking follow-up questions as well as taking notes, and then we have the note taker who spoke Creole and Timni also taking notes. So we didn't have any recorders. Again, the purpose of this was to get data to implement into the response. So we didn't have the funding nor the time to kind of get recorders, and I don't think that would have made sense anyways because we would have needed somebody who spoke Creole and Timni in order to do any kind of transcription. So it was a really interesting dynamic. Some limitations besides the language barrier, the healers were initially hesitant to discuss the practice and experience. So if you imagine that your practice and the job that you've been doing for so many years has recently been banned, and you or some people that you know may be practicing in secret, and then we have people coming from the response to ask you questions about what you're doing. So obviously you're gonna be a little hesitant. So I'm gonna try to get through to the results. So again, just going through healer experience, how Ebola affected their families and communities, and if they're willing to engage in response activities. And this is just a picture of I think it was one of the schoolhouses that we had the focus group in. So quickly, most of the healers were herbalists, and they would process, mix some combined herbs to make concoctions, and they would rub on the skin or drink. And according to them, they treated a whole myriad of illnesses, fractures, infertility, some said HIV, stomach ache, growth, cyst, also a lot of possession by witches or demons. And this is just an example of an advertisement that one of the healers brought to the group just to showcase the work that that he does. So again, the healers had a really high knowledge of Ebola, signs and symptoms, and they understood the transmission and prevention. Similar to most of the community, they had lost family and friends in the outbreak and were quarantined, or knew people that were quarantined. And according to the healers, they expressed trust in the response and in Western medicine. Not in the beginning of the response, but recently they said they have, because they've seen survivors and know that the Western treatment is the best, and actually said there's no herb that can cure Ebola. On the other side, the community had a huge lack of trust and stigma and fear with regard to the response, the Westerners, and what was going on. So they didn't want to be in Ebola house, and they were afraid of being quarantined. So these are just, and I'll go through it quickly, some of the reasons why they wouldn't call 117 if somebody was sick. They didn't want to report family members that were sick. People were still practicing in secret and doing traditional burials in secret because they just didn't trust the response. And again, they talked about why healers are still practicing despite the ban, and it's not rocket science. I mean, poverty is a huge issue, and you're telling somebody who's been doing this all their life that they can't work anymore, they need to make money. And they also talked about how the community really trusts them and how people still come to them for advice and for help. And just quickly, so one of the recommendations from the healers was that messages always tell people what they can't do, but never focus on what they can do. So this is just an example of a billboard that says, avoid unsafe burials, don't touch or wash dead bodies, report all deaths to 117. So again, you're just coming into somebody's community and tell them that something that they've been doing for so long that they just can't do anymore, not giving any alternatives or saying what they can do. And also, just to paint a picture of the burial team, so imagine that you had a loved one who died, and you're used to a ceremony that includes praying and singing, and then somebody comes, you know, three or four people in full PPE and takes your loved one away with no ceremony, and you don't know where they're going, and they're going into this gravesite with other victims. It's actually pretty scary when you think about it. And the biggest recommendation that all the healers talked about was including them in the fight. So they're integral into the health of their community, but they're not included in this huge health concern that is happening in their community. So they wanted to be included in the response activities and feel that the community trusts them and that they can help educate their community about Ebola and to help in the response. So just to follow up again, to come full circle in the process, I presented these results to district leaderships and the health promotion team. So there was a lot of strategies and discussions about changing the messaging, but also thinking about what the positive messaging and what people can do as opposed to telling them what they can't do. And then strategies on how to include the healers in the response. And again, I was only there for a month, so I kind of had to turn this over to the person who came after me, and there was some discussions and program about including the healers into the response. And just in conclusion, I think that the biggest takeaway is how important community engagement is in not just the Ebola response, but any kind of response. So if you think about coming into somebody else's community and trying to help them in any kind of way, you need to have the community engage in what's going on in order to make any kind of impact or to make any kind of change. And I just want to acknowledge my co-author, the CDC health promotion team, all the people I worked with, especially the traditional healers, and all the Ebola responders and everybody who participated in the Ebola response. We were all volunteers who took time away from our jobs, homes, and families to kind of go over there and make some kind of impact. Hopefully I made some kind of impact. It's kind of hard when you're there for such a short time, but we did as much as we could with the resources that we had. Thank you.